From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from Atlanta, Georgia.
But still our struggle continues, because this war is war for rights, for justice. The rights of the detainees, immigrants, and the right of all the people fighting for justice and equality and against racism and oppression. And we continue this struggle until we win.
Palestinian activist Farouk Abdelmouti died last night while giving an address in Philadelphia. He had only been released from detention a few months ago, serving almost 2 years in prison. We'll speak with Farouk's son and his fiancée.
Farouk Abdelmouti will mostly be remembered for his work in the human rights community and as a Palestinian activist who fought actively against oppression all around the globe. It's a great loss to the human rights community. And as activists and humanists, we need to continue his work on Palestinian human rights and on human rights in general.
But first, we'll speak with former Congressmember Cynthia McKinney, who could become a congressman once again. She defeated five opponents in the Democratic primary on Tuesday. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we broadcast from Atlanta, Georgia. Here are the headlines. The final report of the September 11th commission to be released today will call for sweeping changes in congressional oversight of intelligence agencies. The Washington Post is reporting the panel will address the Bush administration's controversial decision not to grant prisoner of war protections to captured al-Qaeda suspects, calling for the development of, quote, a common coalition approach toward the detention and humane treatment of captured terrorists. Lawmakers who have seen the report told the New York Times that the commission would call for a reorganization of domestic intelligence programs within the FBI, although not for a separate domestic security intelligence agency. For an office within the White House with an estimated 200 employees to coordinate the work of the 15 intelligence agencies, and for an interagency counterterrorism center to absorb the smaller anti-terrorism centers that the CIA operates. Information about the previously disclosed recommendation to create a post for a so-called national security director indicates that the director would operate with cabinet-level authority in the executive office of the president, but would not be part of the cabinet. U.S. Marines yesterday killed 25 Iraqi fighters, injured 17, and captured 25 during several hours of fighting in the western city of Ramadi. Military officials said fighting began after a roadside bomb was detonated near a Marine convoy, and Iraqi fighters opened fire with rifles and grenades. Ramadi is one of the Sunni-dominated cities around Baghdad where resistance to the U.S. occupation has been strongest. An Iraqi group is holding seven foreign contract drivers hostage. Video released to news agencies today shows there were three Kenyan hostages, one more than previously announced. The other hostages include three Indians and an Egyptian. The U.S. military has already spent most of the $65 billion approved by Congress to pay for wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now they're struggling to find $12.3 billion more within the Pentagon budget to finance military action through the end of the fiscal year. This, according to a report out from the U.S. General Accounting Office, the most in-depth study of the military's funding problems. The report contradicts White House assurances that the services have enough money to get through the calendar year. The Army, which is overspending its budget by $10.2 billion for operations and maintenance, is asking the Marines and the Air Force to help cover the escalating costs of its logistics contract with Halliburton. A study by the College of Economics at Baghdad University has found that the unemployment rate in Iraq is 70%. The study says the problem of high unemployment is going from bad to worse, with the security situation deteriorating and the reconstruction process faltering. John Kerry's presidential campaign accused the Bush White House yesterday of disclosing the existence of a criminal investigation against former National Security Advisor Sandy Berger for political advantage. Berger is accused of taking secret documents from the National Archives while reviewing Clinton administration records for the 9/11 Commission. In a political memo distributed by email, the Kerry campaign charged that the objective of the leak was to take attention away from the 9/11 Commission's final report, which comes out today. The criminal investigation of Berger began last October, but only came to light this week. Meanwhile, the head of the Democratic National Committee, Terry McAuliffe, filed a Freedom of Information Act request seeking the release of any correspondence between the Justice Department and the White House on the Berger probe. Republicans have accused Bill Clinton's former National Security Advisor of stealing the documents for use by Kerry's campaign. White House spokesperson Scott McClellan said the White House had nothing to do with the disclosure that Berger is under investigation. McClellan said officials in the White House legal counsel's office were made aware of the Berger investigation some time ago because they were in charge of putting together documents for the September 11th commission to see. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan yesterday said the world is no safer today than it was 3 years ago, countering President Bush's claims he had made the world a safer place. At a news conference, Annan also criticized a Bush administration decision to withhold $34 million from the UN Population Fund, saying the agency is saving women's lives. He was responding to a reporter who asked for a comment on the Bush funding move and also whether Annan felt the world had become safer in the last 2 or 3 years. Democrats in Detroit are denouncing a Republican lawmaker quoted in a newspaper as saying the GOP would fare poorly in this year's election if it failed to, quote, suppress the Detroit vote. State Congressmember John Papageorge acknowledged using what he called a bad choice of words, but said his remark shouldn't be considered racist. Papageorge was quoted in July 16th editions of the Detroit Free Press as saying, quote, if we do not suppress the Detroit vote, we're going to have a tough time in this election. African Americans make up more than 80% of Detroit's population. The city routinely gives Democratic candidates a substantial majority of the votes. The U.S. Army is known for its recruiting slogan, Be All You Can Be. But now, according to the New Yorker magazine, the military is offering a new incentive. Soldiers and their families can receive plastic surgery, including breast enlargements, funded by U.S. taxpayers. In its July 26th edition, The New Yorker reports that members of all four branches of the U.S. military can get facelifts, breast enlargements, liposuction, and nose jobs for free, something the military says helps surgeons practice their skills. Dr. Bob Lyons, chief of plastic surgery at Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio, told the magazine, quote, anyone wearing a uniform is eligible. Between 2000 and 2003, military doctors performed almost 500 breast enlargements, more than 1,300 liposuction surgeries on soldiers and their dependents, the magazine said. New Yorker quoted an Army spokeswoman as saying, the surgeons have to have someone to practice on. According to a report released this week by a public interest watch group, tens of thousands of black farmers have yet to see any of the compensation promised them by the U.S. Department of Agriculture 5 years ago in one of the federal government's largest ever racial bias settlements. A two-year probe by the Environmental Working Group and the National Black Farmers Association found that the government had denied restitution to 81,000 out of 94,000 black farmers who sought compensation. The farmers who were seeking payments for unequal treatment when they applied for loan programs and other aid agreed to the settlement in 1999. Clear Channel Communications, the largest radio station owner in the country, sued the distributor of Howard Stern's radio show for $3 million yesterday. The media giant accused Stern of violating federal indecency rules. Stern and distributor Infinity Broadcasting Corporation responded by suing Clear Channel for $10 million. Earlier this year, Clear Channel dropped Stern from six markets. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting from Atlanta, Georgia, last night at Morehouse College, the oldest African-American college for men in the country, founded in 1867, celebrating WRFG Community Radio in Atlanta. I'm Amy Goodman, as we turn now to former Georgia Congressmember Cynthia McKinney, who appears set to make a triumphant return to Congress. She lost her re-election bid 2 years ago after coming under fierce attack for her early call for a 9/11 investigation of the Bush administration. Cynthia McKinney won 51% of the vote in a Democratic primary here on Tuesday, defeating five opponents and avoiding a runoff election in August. She'll now face Republican Catherine Davis in November in a heavily Democratic district. She is considered a shoo-in to win back her seat. We spoke to her earlier this week when she faced the primary. Now she is won. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Cynthia McKinney.
Thank you, Amy, for inviting me to be with you again this morning. Of course, we're not taking anything for granted. We understand that the people spoke and the people spoke with a unified voice on July 20th at the election, but that was a Democratic part of the district, and now we're moving forward so that we can represent the entire district. That means that the energy of the campaign will be sustained until November.
It's interesting to be talking to you today, considering the controversy around you calling early on for a 9/11 investigation. Today, the report coming out. Your thoughts?
Well, I'm pleased. I anticipate the publication of the report. I am pleased that they stepped away from the earlier floated idea of creating a Department of Domestic Intelligence, because that is wholly unneeded and unnecessary. I do have some questions about the centralization of intelligence after having read the Colleen Rowley memo and understanding that exactly what she was complaining about in her memo was the centralization of decision-making in one place that hampered the ability of the field agents to do their job and to do their job well. So, you know, I'll have to get a copy of the report and actually go through it to digest exactly what their recommendations are and to counter that with the information that I have and the opinions that I have about what needs to be done.
What do you think are the most important issues that need to be addressed now in Congress, and are they different from when you were there 2 years ago?
I'm sure the issues in some way are different. But more important, probably more important than anything, is that we've got to get our economic house in order. We've got record deficits. We've got a record national debt. The Republican Congress is trying to figure out a way to raise the debt ceiling so no one will know. We've had an important expansion of the USA Patriot Act that needs to be dealt with. Civil liberties need to be dealt with. And this whole issue of security needs to be dealt with, but it needs to be dealt with in a way that actually resolves our problems and makes Americans more secure. Well, of course, we've got to deal with the war, and we've got to bring our young men and women home. I saw today where Bush is okaying arms sales to Iraq. The last thing we need to be doing is extending our own weapons of mass destruction, putting more into the hands of a government as yet untested. And so there ought to be economic assistance, if there's going to be any assistance at all, humanitarian assistance. We've got a legacy of the depleted uranium that's still there. We need to stop using depleted uranium weapons. There's so many issues that need to be dealt with. And, of course, my area when I was in Congress before was the Armed Services Committee and the International Relations Committee. So I'll be looking at those issues, but I will also be looking at the economic issues and how we can benefit truly small businesses so that we can have a localized economy that is sustainable, that makes sense, and creates a quality of life for local people in their local areas.
Cynthia McKinney, I want to thank you very much for being with us, former Congress member who could be back in Congress this next year. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Amy.
This is Democracy Now! As we continue on our discussion of Georgia politics, we're joined by John Sugg. He is senior editor for Creative Loafing, which is an Atlanta-based alternative weekly newspaper. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Glad to be here.
Was this a surprise, this Cynthia McKinney victory, not just victory, but actually not having to go to a runoff?
I think the margin of victory was a surprise, but she was only defeated by a Republican crossover vote, which Georgia allows. It's sort of a part of the old South that remains here. This is 2 years ago. So, you know, the Republicans had other races to vote in. You can't mixture your primaries that you vote in each race. So the Republicans voted in their primaries, and she won. She's very popular in her district. The Republicans hate her. The daily newspaper in this town hates her. They constantly misrepresent what she said about the Bush investigation.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Yes, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And even in her victory, they still misrepresent what she says. And so her win against the media, against, you know, this huge Republican organization in the state, I think was a very encouraging sign for progressive people.
Now, she is vying for her old seat, the seat that the Democrat,
right,
Denise Majette, actually,
right,
won, who is now running for the U.S. Senate. What are her chances, and who is she running against?
Slim and none. She's running against a popular Republican, Johnny Isaacson, who won the Republican primary without a runoff.
This is for the seat of Zellmiller?
Zellmiller, right. And Denise Majette's she turned out to be a pretty good member of Congress. A lot of resentment within her district because she defeated McKinney, but she went up there and she grew into the job. She still has to beat a gentleman named Oxford, Chris Oxford, who has no credentials but has a huge war chest. He's actually probably more progressive in his politics than Majette. But the way this state, the demographics of the state, Georgia is half Atlanta, half everywhere else, and everywhere else tends to vote very conservative. And so I think that the Republican will walk into this one with 60% of the vote.
Hmm. John Sugg, we were just in Tampa, where we were broadcasting from. And there we did the story of Sami Alarian. In a few minutes, we're going to deal with a very sad story in New York. Certainly changed our show late last night because of the death of Farouk Abdelmouti, who was just released from detention after almost 2 years there, a Palestinian activist. I'm not going to go through Sami Alarian's case again, who remains in detention, but you have written extensively about it. It is a case that could determine the balance of the Senate as well because of the Democratic, one of the Democratic contenders for the seat. And I was wondering if you could briefly say your involvement with this story as a reporter and maybe even talk about those politics of what could mean.
Well, I've been covering this story since it broke in 95, and mostly as a media story, how a guy named Steve Emerson, who you're familiar with, a self-declared terrorism expert, whose job—
Wrote the book Jihad in America.
Right, which had so many mistakes, it's hilarious, okay? But his job has been to silence Arabs and Muslims in America, okay? We fought a four-year lawsuit with Emerson and won. But the Sami Alarian case is really significant because, you know, if we talk about this 9/11 report, at the time, the government was spending millions and millions of dollars chasing Alarian, thousands of hours, tens of thousands of hours of work on this case in Florida. Just a few miles away down in Hollywood, Florida, Mohammed Atta was living, FBI apparently totally unaware, okay? And that's the sort of thing. The chief prosecutor in Alarian's case is a fundraiser for the Irish Republican Army. Okay? Now, you consider that. I mean, prosecutors within the U.S. Attorney's Office in Tampa have told me they're angry at this prosecution because, you know, the guy who the chief of the criminal division is an active fundraiser for Sinn Féin and the IRA. Well, it's okay to be you know, in America, it's okay to raise money for the IRA. They're good terrorists, okay? But I'm joking. But the real story here is selective enforcement.
So you have this University of Southern Florida professor, Sami Alarian,
right,
who they strung along for quite a while, and then they ultimately have detained him. They arrested and detained him. If you can just very briefly say why the FBI is setting its sights on you now.
Well, the FBI has demanded, after I wrote a series of articles that are very embarrassing to the U.S. Attorney's Office, including my articles probably cost the U.S. Attorney in Tampa a chance to be a federal judge. Okay, they're angry. And so they came after me. They're demanding all of my sources. The FBI calls me up and says, John, we want to know all your sources. They did this later with two other reporters, okay? We're the reporters, the three reporters, who have been critical of the government, okay? They asked me, one of their questions was, we want to know all the lies that Sami Alarian told you. I said, well, you know something, I've known Sami Alarian for a number of years now. I do not know one time he has overtly told me a lie. But the federal government, in many occasions, has told lies. They just admitted in court the other day that they lied about the use of informers. I think it's very dangerous. I think that if we do not have a new president after November, that I think the press will be under increasing attack. And as you well know, the mainstream media is more than happy to be the lapdog for the administration. But I think to be critical of the government will mean for a reporter that you're going to have the FBI on you.
John Sugg is senior editor for Creative Loafing, an alternative weekly newspaper here in Atlanta, Georgia. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Yeah.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The struggle for Palestinian human rights has lost one of its leading fighters in the U.S. Farouk Abdelmouti, a member of the Pacifica radio station WBAI family, died last night, apparently of a heart attack, while he was giving a speech in Philadelphia. His death comes just 3 months after he was released from jail, where he was detained for almost 2 years without charge. He was 57 years old. Farouk Abdelmouti was born in 1947 in Ramallah, a Palestinian city in the occupied West Bank of Jordan. Like many Palestinians, he lived the uprooted life of a stateless refugee, traveling from country to country until finally settling in New York in the 1970s. He made it his home and has lived there ever since. He came to the attention of immigration officials in the mid-70s after overstaying his visa. An immigration judge ordered him deported. However, there was no way to carry out the deportation since the West Bank was now controlled by Israel, which did not allow the return of people who left the Palestinian territories before the Israeli occupation of 1967. Farouk continued to live openly in New York, engaging in a number of public political activities, a focus, of course, Palestinian rights and issues relating to immigration in Latin America. In March 2002, Farouk began working regularly at Pacifica station WBAI. He used his contacts to arrange interviews with Palestinians in the occupied territories and worked with us on Wake Up Call, WBAI's morning show. A month after he started working with us, three New York police officers and an INS agent, all in civilian dress, came to his Queens apartment without a warrant. They claimed they wanted to ask Farouk some questions about September 11th. They said they were there were weapons and explosives in the apartment. When Farouk's roommate, Bernard McFall, refused to open the door, they threatened to break it down, entering without a warrant. But Farouk wasn't home because he was with us at WBAI. He learned of the raid from his roommate and son, Tarek. Farouk was detained on April 26, 2002, jailed in various facilities around the country for 2 years, never charged with a crime, often held in solitary confinement, subjected to extensive interrogation, often denied food. His health was failing, but he remained handcuffed and shackled whenever he went to the health clinic. Almost 2 years after his detention, a federal judge said he either had to be charged, deported, or released. Ultimately, Farouk was released. Last night, after giving a speech at the Ethical Society in Philadelphia, Farouk collapsed and died. This is an excerpt of what he had to say last night.
I am thank you very much for your invitation, but, you know, I want to explain to you very clear. Our struggle, you understand, is not depend from one faction in the United States. I thank you to all of you, from the all the groups here, because all of you is the one support my struggle. All of you is giving to I win my freedom. And our resistance continues, and especially from the progressive groups, together, without difference in our ideology, without differences of the ones who try to be Pac-Mans and dedicate himself to be the power to control our ideas. I prefer the ideas coming from all of you. I prefer the ideas from the small group, from a small faction, from a small organization, from the left, progressive forces, and from humanitarian forces to be together and fight the same enemy, which is imperialism. And imperialism, his command is using the two sides. You have the side that's know your enemy, and you have the other side is hiding under the shadow of the enemy, which indirectly is afraid to talk about it truth and talk about the plans, what is against our rights. But I believe nobody can stop the Palestinian struggle, and I believe it's not going to stop our assistance for rights. Thank you.
As the crowd applauded, Farouk Abdelmouti's head hit the table. He died soon after. We're joined in the studio by Shireen Chiarrazzo. I am in Atlanta. Shireen is in our Democracy Now! Studios in New York. She was the fiancé and longtime friend of Farouk Abdelmouti. She was with him last night in Philadelphia. We're also joined by Tariq Abdelmouti, Farouk's son. And we extend our condolences to you and your family and to your friends. Shireen, can you talk about Farouk?
Yes. Would you like me to talk about his life, or would you like me to talk about what happened last night as far
well,
as
Well, talk about, start with last night,
okay.
How he was feeling, the message okay. he was trying to convey.
Okay. Basically, well, Farouk was continuing his work, like as you were referring to, after he was released from prison about 2 months ago. He started going on extensive speaking tours, in addition to going on, you know, WBAI's wake-up call. And many, many organizations were asking him to speak. He was getting many interviews and a lot of write-ups, and there's been biographies that have been produced about him, and he was trying to go and spread the message about not only about the plight of what he went through, or not only about his experience under detention and torture in the United States, but also he always referred back to the plight of the Palestinians, and he always referred back to the plight and the problems facing his people in Palestine and all around the globe. And he always reiterated and emphasized the fact that Palestinians are victims of terrorism, they are opposed to terrorism, and that he personally is opposed to terrorism, but believes in the right to fight for his rights and his land. So he was doing this, being invited to many, many forums. Last week it was Oakland, California. This weekend it was to be the Socialist Forum in Boston, Massachusetts, and in Philadelphia, the Ethical Society had invited him to speak on a panel on the anti-war forum, where there were a number of human rights groups there, local activists as well as local Philadelphia area human rights groups, and the Socialist Party of Pennsylvania. And so basically what he was starting to do was he was explaining his experience with the U.S. Marshals and with the U.S. Marshals Service and Immigration Service while he was detained and before. The experience leading up to his detention when he went on WBAI Radio Pacifica 99.5 FM and started broadcasting live broadcasts from the occupied territories, getting on guests that were able to give true accounts of what was happening on the ground. And this had not been being shown by the mainstream media, obviously. So he was getting on some prominent guests and people who were on the ground when the Jenin massacres occurred, in which between 100 and 500 people were you know, killed or died as their houses fell down on them. He was getting live broadcasts from there. He was also getting live broadcasts from the Mukatta compound in Ramallah when the Israelis put this the compound under siege and had Arafat, Yasser Arafat, holed up in it. And basically, you know, he went into the details about that and about how after he had been on the air for about a month, the FBI agents and the INS, the immigration officials, went to harass him and, you know, went to ask him about his paperwork. So he went into all details about that, and then he just started to get into the details of his of when he was detained and in basically in 9 jails in the United States, of which 8 months and 10 days were spent in solitary confinement in York, Pennsylvania, the conditions and how he felt when he was alerted by the panel that he needed to cut the time. He was the last speaker. So they said, you know, you need to cut the time. And he basically gave an inspirational message to the human rights community and the progressive community, giving them credit and, you know, for his release and telling them to continue the struggle. And he said thank you, and then as we saw on the tape, he collapsed. After that, you know, we didn't really know what to do. We were surprised. We thought he fell asleep. We thought he was, you know, just passed out. Someone in the audience was a CPR, tried to do CPR on him, called an ambulance immediately. They tried to revive him for 10 or 15 minutes in the hall itself. in the ambulance and when we got to the hospital. But he never seemed to have continued breathing since then. He had no breath, no breathing, and no pulse from the time that he was in the hole. After about a half hour in the hospital, the medics informed us that they were not able to revive him and that they were not going to be able to revive him. We asked what was the cause of death, and they said they assumed it was a heart attack. However, we do have to get the medical examiner's report today because we don't have a confirmed cause of death as of this point.
Mm. We're talking to Shireen Chirazo, the longtime friend and fiancé of Farouk Abdelmouti, Palestinian activist who died last night giving a speech in Philadelphia. Tariq, again, our condolences to you and to your family. This is hitting you very hard, I know. What about your father's health in detention for almost 2 years? What kind of attention did he receive? We were hearing about his being ill there.
Well, relatively not as much medical attention as anyone outside of jail would, and especially in the conditions that he was in, getting transferred from prison to prison. You know, the medical conditions were always bad, you know, because it's part of an overall problem with the prison system within the United States. And my father was a victim of this.
I wanted to turn for a moment to April 13th. This was the day after Farouk Abdelmouti had been flown to LaGuardia after the federal judge said that he had to be released if he wasn't charged or deported. And so he was first flown south and then to LaGuardia Airport. That was the night, coincidentally, that we began our exception to the ruler's tour around this country. We were at Cooper Union Hall. 1,000 people had come out. Tim Robbins first spoke, the actor, and Farouk Abdelmouti came into the hall. I was concerned it would be overwhelming after he had spent so many months in solitary confinement. But he came up on the stage. Bernard White and Jeremy Scahill were there emceeing the event. Bernard of WBAI, we had worked with Farouk together in the morning show. Jeremy, of course, Democracy Now! Producer and correspondent. And Farouk came up on the stage. This is what he had to say.
Deep of my heart, I thanks to all of you because I am a small atom of your society and your communities. And I thanks to the WBI and Radio Pacifica and Democracy Now! To support me and to continue this struggle to I win in this moment the freedom. But still our struggle continues because this war is war for rights, for justice. The rights of the detainees, immigrants, and the right of all the people fighting for justice and equality and against racism and oppression. And we continue this struggle until we win.
Farouk Abdelmouti speaking on April 13th to 1,000 people in New York City just after he had been released from almost 2 years in detention. That morning, April 13th, as he had just come into New York, we talked to him on the phone on Democracy Now! This is what he had to say.
As we bring you this national broadcast exclusive, Palestinian activist Farouk Abdelmouti is out of jail after almost 2 years. He was never charged with a crime. A prominent Palestinian activist in the New York area has just returned to New York. We welcome him to Democracy Now!'s airwaves. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Farouk Abdelmouti.
Thank you very much, sister and comrade Amy Goodman, and thank you for Democracy Now! And all of yours to support me, because I feel myself part of yours, you know that, and this struggle, what is today, continue for the Constitution of Rights and for the rights of the people in the nation and overseas is a linkage one to the other ones. And we have to admire people like you, what is continue in a struggle for our rights. Yes, I win my freedom yesterday, 3:30. I was in a box in and a place is called him United States Penitentiary, what is a big penitentiary located 15 minutes from the airport of Atlanta, Georgia. And after he moved me from there to the office of the INS, and INS tell me you have to go to Reagan Airport with Delta, and after you have your freedom, and give me some papers to sign it. I think the paper is from the Israeli embassy to sign about my papers, because according to him, she say, you know, if it's possible, you can be, Israel is going to set Palestinians. And after put me in the airport to the airplane, and I move from there to Reagan Airport in Washington, and after from there I come in U.S. Airlines, and I arrive in the LaGuardia Airport 10 o'clock. What my friends and my family and the people support me and, you know, support my freedom. What I think my freedom and my rights is some supposed to be part of the examples in a struggle for justice and equality and rights in the society of United States, what is built up for all different communities and all different ethnics to create a new society with democracy and rights.
Farouk Abdelmouti, the morning he returned to New York after almost 2 years in detention. Tariq Abdelmouti in the studio, his son. Tariq, your final thoughts.
Well, my final thoughts right now are that, well, okay, my father's passed on, but his memory has not, well, it hasn't gone away. I guess you can say it'll transcend, you know, to different generations. You know, his message will continue to go on, because, well, you know, that would be like the essence of his spirit. And, you know, my father's case is a prime example of many of the abuses that happen within the American prison system, and is also an example in the grand scheme of things of how victimized the Palestinian people are becoming, and basically what the United States government is doing to the Palestinian people. I mean, the United States government isn't directly killing and intimidating Palestinians, but it certainly is doing it indirectly when, in the name of anti-terrorism, a voice like my father's is silenced, and, you know, when at the same time, you know, our government continues to give billions of dollars of military and financial aid to Israel, to the state of Israel, for,
well,
like the past 30 years.
Tariq Abdelmouti and Shireen Chirazo, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Again, our condolences. Farouk Abdelmouti, Palestinian activist, human rights leader, died last night in Philadelphia after giving an address. Farouk was 57 years old. This
thank
is Democracy
you.
Now! We'll be back
thank you,
in
Amy.
A minute. Thank you. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Atlanta, Georgia, on our exception to the Ruler's Tour. As we turn now to the fourth in our five-part series of convention coverage from the Pacifica Radio Archives, this documentary called Passel of Pomp, Circus of Circumstance, convention coverage of the Pacifica Radio Archives.
In the year leading up to the 1984 presidential election, the odds looked good for the Democrats to unseat President Reagan. In 1982, during the midterm elections, Democrats won 75% of the governor's races and 60% of the congressional seats. Also in their favor is the nation's high unemployment rate, which had climbed steadily during Reagan's tenure, so much so that in July 1983, economic data shows the nation's unemployment rate is down to 9.8%, but unemployment among African Americans remains at 20.6%. On September 21, 1983, Reagan's Interior Secretary, James Watt, defends his Cole Advisory Commission makeup by saying, "I have a black, I have a woman, two Jews, and a cripple." Immediately, a storm of protest hits Watt, and he resigns his post on October 9th. Nearly a month after his resignation, on the 3rd of November, Jesse Jackson, coming from the opposite spectrum, declares his candidacy for the 1984 Democratic presidential nomination. He speaks of a rainbow coalition of blacks, Hispanics, women, the disabled, and other minorities who, he says, have been oppressed by the policies of the Reagan administration. In January 1984, Jesse Jackson, traveling as a private citizen, speaks with Syrian President Hafez Assad and obtains the release of U.S. Airman Robert Goodman Jr. Although initially applauded for his effort, it comes back to haunt Jackson later when he's criticized as being a loose cannon and someone who does not play by the rules. After March 13th, or Super Tuesday, the Democratic race is narrowed to two men— former Vice President Walter Mondale, who wins Georgia and Alabama, and Senator Gary Hart, who wins Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Florida. By the end of May, Walter Mondale is the clear favorite, having won Illinois, New York, Pennsylvania, Texas, New Jersey, and West Virginia, with only two losses other than that first loss in New Hampshire. Washington, D.C., and Louisiana both go to Jesse Jackson. In July, Mondale, after securing his party's nomination, names Geraldine Ferraro to be his running mate.
Thank you, Vice President Mondale.
Making Ferraro the first woman to ever appear on a major party ticket.
Vice President, it has such a nice ring to it. I want to thank Fritz Mondale for asking the convention to nominate me as his running mate. This choice says a lot about him, about where the country has come, and about where we want to lead it.
And on July 17th, Jesse Jackson delivers a passionate speech at the DNC in San Francisco, which, according to Nielsen ratings, had the unusual effect of doubling his listening audience from the time he began his speech to when it ended 50 minutes later.
We come together, bound by our faith in the mighty God, with genuine respect and love for our country, and inheriting the legacy of a great party, the Democratic Party, which is the best hope for redirecting our nation on a more humane, just, and peaceful course. This is not a perfect party. We are not a perfect people. Yet we are called to a perfect mission. Our mission: to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, to house the homeless, to teach the illiterate, to provide jobs for the jobless, and to choose the human race over the nuclear race. Gathered here this week to nominate a candidate and adopt a platform which will expand, unify, direct, and inspire our party
and the nation to fulfill this mission. My constituency is the desperate, the damned, the disinherited, the disrespected, and the despised. They are restless and seek relief. They have voted in record numbers. They have invested the faith, hope, and trust that they have in us. From Fannie Lou Hamer in Atlantic City in 1964 to the Rainbow Coalition in San Francisco today, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, we've experienced pain but progress as we ended America's apartheid laws. We got public accommodations. We secured voting rights. We obtained open housing as young people got the right to vote. We lost Malcolm, Martin, Medgar, Bobby, John, and Viola. The team that got us here must be expanded, not abandoned. Our time has come. Our time has come. Suffering breeds character. Character breeds faith. In the end, faith will not disappoint. Our time has come. Our faith, hopes, and dreams will prevail. Our time has come. Weeping has endured for a night, but now joy cometh in the morning. Our time has come. No grave can hold our body down. Our time has come. No lie can live forever. Our time has come. We must leave racial battleground and come to economic common ground and moral higher ground. America, our time has come. We've come from disgrace to amazing grace. Our time has come. Give me your tired. Give me your poor, your huddled masses who yearn to breathe free. And come November, there will be a change because our time has come. Thank you, and God bless you.
Jackson, a man with a split personality. He is sometimes Jesse Jackson, the politician, and at other times, he's Jesse Jackson, the preacher. Tonight, you've got a combination of both. This morning, you've got Jesse Jackson, the preacher. The thing about it is, there are people here, if you can believe this, with tears. I mean, actually crying. And that is something that, as long as I have been covering Jesse Jackson's speeches, sermons, if you will, I have never before witnessed such an event. I stand here as a reporter trying to remain just that, a reporter cool, calm, and thoroughly collected. But right now, I am in shambles, if I must say. But I will try to piece myself back together to give you what you would want, to give you what I will, a taste of what the people feel for Jesse Jackson. Just listen to the crowd for a few moments yourself, and
Pacifica reporter Wendell Harper caught up in the moment. Despite the mood inside the convention hall and Jesse Jackson's prediction of their time has come, Ronald Reagan and George Bush will win the election in November by winning 49 of 50 states and 525 out of 538 electoral votes, thus securing the country 4 more years of Reaganomics. On May 8th, former Colorado Senator Gary Hart, more than 20 percentage points ahead of his nearest competitor in the race for the 1988 Democratic presidential nomination, drops out of the race. He had been plagued by rumors of infidelity and womanizing. Earlier in the campaign, he challenged reporters to put a tail on me. Evidently, they did. 4 days earlier, reporters published photos of Hart with 29-year-old model Donna Rice sitting on his lap aboard the good ship Monkey business as it sailed for the Bahamas in the Atlantic Ocean. With his exit, Michael Dukakis assumes the front-runner position. During the month of July 1987, for 3 weeks, the nation is transfixed, watching Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North testifying before a congressional committee about his role in the Iran-Contra affair. Early in 1988, Michael Dukakis and Vice President George Bush go on a string of primary victories across the country. It is not until March 26 that either of them will fail to win a primary. When in Michigan, the Reverend Jesse Jackson takes the Democratic Party caucus, defeating Dukakis by 55% to 28%. Jackson quickly becomes Dukakis's toughest competition, and in April, Jackson carries New York City but loses the state to Dukakis. It is not until June that Dukakis wraps up the nomination with wins in California, Montana, New Jersey, and New Mexico. By the time the DNC gets underway in Atlanta, Georgia, on July 20th, 1988, Michael Dukakis and his newly announced running mate, Lloyd Benson of Texas, hold a comfortable lead over George Bush, according to the polls. After the convention, the race grows tighter after a series of debates, but shifts dramatically to George Bush's favor after Dukakis' efforts to quell criticisms that he knows nothing of the military include a photo op of Dukakis driving a tank. This is usually the one image most people remember of the entire election. Michael Dukakis's head sticking out of a massive tank, a boyish grin etched across his face.
And this is Passel of Pomp, Circus of Circumstance. Convention coverage passed from the Pacifica Radio Archives. Tomorrow we'll bring you our final installment. If you'd like to get a copy of the full 2 hours of this documentary from Pacifica's history, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359 for a copy of the DVD, video, or double CD set of this 5 days through the archives. Next week, Democracy Now!, the entire team will be in Boston covering the convention. We'll be bringing you 2 hours of coverage. Stations can run one or both of those hours, called Breaking with Convention: War, Peace, and the Presidency. We'll be in the streets and in the corporate suites covering the convention as well, of course, in New York at the Republican National Convention. I'm looking forward to seeing people in this Exception to the Rulers tour as we continue today broadcasting from Atlanta, Georgia. Tomorrow, on Friday night, looking forward to seeing listeners to WOMR, Outermost Radio in Provincetown, Massachusetts. I'll be with Norman Mailer at Provincetown Town Hall. That's on Friday night in Provincetown, Massachusetts. On Saturday, we'll be in New York. I'll be at the Boston Social Forum, 6 o'clock, Healy Library at University of Massachusetts, Boston. Jeremy will be at the Social Forum earlier in the day at 1:30. At 8 o'clock, I'll be at the Veterans for Peace dinner at the Boston Public Library, Bates Hall. The following Friday night, Nantucket at the Unitarian Universalist Church. And you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! And the archive, we thank Pacifica Radio Archive, our team, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Dennis Moynihan, Jeremy Scahill, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.